Morning, everybody. Pardon me a moment while I get myself together here. All right, Matthew 6. 1 through 18, that's our text for this morning. And so if you're not there already, I encourage you to get there very quickly because that's where we're going to camp. Thank you, brothers in the back.
I think we all know kind of instinctively that we are hardwired to work for some kind of reward. And we even see that happening at very early ages. So we're trying to train the twins to use potties. And by we, I mostly mean Jenny is doing the vast majority of that really excellent good work, which I very much appreciate. And even at 3 years old, our twins understand, boy, if I control my bodily functions to where I go to the bathroom in a certain place at a certain time, then I get some candy for that. I get, you know, 5 M&Ms at 2 in the afternoon when none of the rest of the siblings are. You know, that carries some motivation with it, right? And even as adults, we understand that we often do things in our lives because we're looking for some kind of reward, some kind of recognition from the boss, some kind of pay raise, some kind of something at the end of the day or the week or the month or whatever it is. And that's hardwired into us because ultimately we are designed to look to God, our Creator, ultimately for our praise. And Jesus will talk about that in his teachings. But what Satan wants to do is he wants to take that innate desire that is good, and he wants to redirect it so that we're looking to other people around us to give us the reward and the praise that we seek. And so in this section of Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, he's going to address 3 classic areas that the Jews would practice their righteousness in. He's going to talk about fasting. He's going to talk about prayer. He's going to talk about giving. And he's going to say, you know, you need to make sure that you are doing all those good things with an eye to God and not as a way of increasing your reputation in the eyes of other people. When it comes to rewards from man or rewards from God, God says, my reward for you is so much better than anything else that you could get from somebody else. So what he's going to do is he's going to teach on hypocrisy. And you know, you may have noticed that in the reading that Ryan just did. In 3 different places, in these 3 different sections, that's what happens in verse 2, verse 5, verse 16. He starts these things by saying, do not be like the hypocrites. I think the tone of chapter 6 is just continuing from chapter 5. Jesus is starting with a demo moment. He is blowing up. He is taking a jackhammer and he is destroying the false ways that people have thought about serving God. Remember in chapter 5, what we talked about last week is a lot of, you have heard that it was said, when you go to the synagogue and the rabbi gets up and he talks about what every other rabbi thinks about this, and he redirects you away from the intention of God in the law, and he tells you about something else. And so he says, you've heard what people have said about this, but that wasn't right. It didn't address the heart. So here's what I say to you. Well, chapter 6 is functioning in the same kind of way. Starts with the negative. Don't be like this. Don't do this. And then he ends with the positive, right? Instead, here's how to practice your righteousness. I think the word hypocrite that he uses here is kind of a word that we take for granted sometimes in the way that we use the word. But I just want to spend a little bit of time unpacking the importance of the where this sits right here in the New Testament. Did you know that the word hypocrite that's used here is only used by Jesus in the gospel? So you look at the epistles, Romans, Corinthians, Galatians. It's nowhere to be found. The concepts are found there. But this word is only in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, not in John. Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's used 17 times. 13 of those times are in the gospel that we are working through every week. And 4 different times in Matthew, it's being used in the Sermon on the Mount. And, like we just said, 3 of those 4 times are in 1 through 16, or 1 through 18 of chapter 6. Right here. I want you to think about what that word signified to them. A hypocrites in the Greek was originally somebody who was an actor on a stage, in the way that the Greeks spoke and used that word. And I think it's interesting when you think about Greek actors and you compare them to our own. You know, when you go to the movies and you see some Hollywood actors getting up on the screen, usually, you know, they're dressed in certain ways. Maybe they've done their hair in different ways. But usually you can see their faces, even though they might, you know, put on different costumes and whatnot. But that was not usually the case when you went to go see a Greek play. Usually those actors would routinely cover their faces with various masks depending on the part that they were playing. They would change their facial appearance and project a different image from what they actually looked like. And why were actors doing what they did? What were actors hoping to receive from being a hypocrites? They were hoping to receive this, right? Standing ovations. Amphitheaters filled with people singing their praises, buying more and more tickets to come and see them perform, being the center, almost the literal center of attention in the way that the amphitheaters were set up. You know, the guy stands right here and everybody is in this semicircle around where he is. That's a hypocrite in the way that they thought about that in their culture. And so Jesus is comparing insincere Jews to pagan play actors. You can imagine that that might have raised some eyebrows in the crowd. And saying, that's what you guys are like when you're doing this. Now, I want to make a distinction here, because the way that we think about hypocrisy can be used in a couple of different ways. There are different kinds of hypocrisy. But I want you to notice the type that Jesus is talking about in this text. So sometimes we talk about hypocrisy as somebody who is talking a good game and they are saying the right things and they're making a show of, I'm a good person, but actually in their private life they're a bad person. And actually they're not walking the walk. Actually, when you scrutinize their daily activities, it's not measuring up to what they're saying about themselves, what the claims are, what they're preaching. And in fact, when you look up hypocrisy in an English dictionary, it's going to say this. This is from the Oxford American. The practice of claiming to have moral standards or beliefs to which one's own behavior does not conform. I want you to notice carefully, though, that's not exactly what Jesus is talking about here. The kind of hypocrisy he is targeting is, you are doing the right things. You are praying, you are giving, you are fasting, but the problem is where that's coming from inside of you is messed up. So eventually, that messed up heart might lead you to not be doing the right things, but that's what he's talking about here, is you're doing all of what you're doing for human applause. It's good that you pray, it's good that you give, it's good that you fast, but you need to look at where that is coming from. That's the hypocrisy that he is looking at here. And this was a repeated problem for the people that he often worked with. And this is something that you do find in the Gospel of John. in a couple of different places, he directly calls them out. So in John chapter 5, in verse 44, he says this flat out to the Jews, "How can you believe? How can you have faith in me when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God?" And so living our lives with an eye on other people is going to set up all kinds of faith roadblocks that will prevent us from serving our God. That was true of the Jews, but it's also going to be true of us too. John chapter 12, you see this playing out later on in the book, where Jesus says this, or John says this, "They loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God." And in that context, in John 12, John is talking about the Jews who actually did believe that Jesus was legit. He looks like he's the real deal. But they would not declare that. They would not acknowledge that because they were scared silly of being kicked out of the synagogue. You know, I need to make sure that I keep my community and I keep my status and I keep the way that I've been living my life. And so I cannot say the truth about Jesus. Is seeking human glory a problem for you, for me? This is a kind of a deceptive thing, because on the surface we might think, well, you know, sure, it's a temptation, but I don't know if that's really a daily struggle. I want you to ask yourself this. The next time that you plan a act of kindness for somebody else, somebody else here, somebody else on the outside, would you ask yourself this question: would I still do this thing if I knew that, coming into it, no other human would know that I had done it? I get uncomfortable when I start asking myself that question with the things that I'm trying to do. Here's another question that's also uncomfortable. Are you ever tempted to quit doing something good because you have not received a lot of compliments lately for whatever it is that you're doing, that you're working hard in for Jesus? Do you often frame your decisions with this question in your mind of, well, if I do that thing, if I say that thing, what are other people going to think about that? Does that enter into your mind sometimes? Does mine. And as somebody who routinely gets up in front of other people and says things, that is often a question that the Lord has to tamp down and destroy in my heart. Because my job is at the end of the day not to make you like me. I'd like you to like me. But my job at the end of the day is to make sure that I am giving you this. And sometimes this is very uncomfortable for me and for you. But that's what Scripture does in the song that Byron led us in just a moment ago. It equips us for good. And sometimes that means breaking down the bad. So this is something that's not just a problem for the Jews. This can be a problem for us. And so with all that in our mind, I want you to think about these three different categories of righteous deeds that he works through in the text, starting with 1 through 4, starting with this idea of giving. He says, you know, you need to make sure that you don't serve other people with your money or any other way of serving people. Make sure that you are not doing that so that you can be viewed as a really great, unselfish, kind person. You can share, and you should share, without broadcasting. Sometimes we'll use this phrase, man, he is tooting his own horn. You ever said that? Do you notice in the text that that is what is happening here? I don't know if, I tried to read some things about this There's not a lot of historical data on Jews actually going to street corners and places in public and actually taking a trumpet and saying, do-do-do, everybody look, I am now giving to this person right here on the street corner. I'm now giving to the temple. But whether it was something that was literally happening or not, like, we get the picture, we get the concept here. And so he says, you know, you should be generous, but, and even though that person that you give to may know exactly what you've done for them, nobody else needs to know about that. It's not for you to mention to other people. This is so applicable, isn't it? Because doesn't this principle overlap into all the other kinds of Christian service that we should be active and engaged in as disciples of Jesus? You should be visiting hospital beds. And lately, there's been some hospital rooms to visit. When you take a brother aside, like Aquila and Priscilla did for Apollos, and you teach your brother or your sister the way of God more accurately, when you take someone into your home and you feed them and you show them the love of Christ and you encourage them and you initiate a relationship with them, when you do anything to spend your time and your energy on somebody else, there is going to be a temptation to say, okay, did anybody else see that? Because what I just did there was good. We are laying up treasure in heaven if we do not try to gain praise here. Let's talk about praying. And it's kind of interesting to me that this is a much longer section of the three different actions that he covers here. Praying goes from 5 to 15, and he talks very extensively about not turning communication with God into a piety show, because God doesn't want the fancy or the rote, repetitious words that were common in the ancient world. When you prayed to your gods, it was really common to just heap it on and just to say a whole bunch of nonsense gobbledygook in the hopes that you could manipulate your God based on the mountain of things that you said to him or her. God doesn't want that. He wants your utter dependence on him. So I want to make this point about what he's saying here. I think when Jesus is condemning the teachers, the religious people who like to stand in verse 5 and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, I really don't think that he is condemning public prayer, which is good, because if he was, we'd have to change some things around here. But we see Jesus leading public prayers sometimes. Like later on in chapter 14, chapter 15, he is blessing a meal in front of thousands of people and saying whatever else that he said there. In chapter 26, he is sitting at the table, the Lord's Supper table, with 12 other guys, and he is leading a prayer there in front of them. So he prayed in front of others, but his point here is you better not use that time as an opportunity to try to impress other people, to try to heap on the words in order to make yourself look impressive because you had done all the things that you need to do. When I was growing up, sometimes I heard certain Christians getting up in front of the congregation and always saying certain phrases in their public prayers. I heard a lot of guide, guard, and direct us. I heard a lot of help the preacher to have a ready recollection. And I want to be clear about that there's nothing inherently wrong with praying those things. But we should not feel like we can't pray in front of other people unless we check all the boxes, make sure that we hit all the categories, and say certain things in certain ways. I want to make this point too. I think in this congregation, we don't really struggle with that. That's not a huge thing that we need to correct here. I don't see a lot of guys coming up and saying incredibly long, formulaic prayers. But I do want to challenge us with a couple of questions to think about related to this, like the question of, if you're somebody who does lead prayers in front of the rest of the congregation, do you pray at home too, aside from what you do with meals? And if you are praying at home, are you doing that diligently? Are you sincerely opening up your heart to God in your closet, in your home, where it's not in front of 90 other people like it is here? Or do you just say praying for when you're up in front of others and you want to look sincere? That's what Jesus is targeting here. But I love that Jesus doesn't stop there. He gives us, notice starting in verse 9, he gives us a model to use. And so many people throughout 2,000 years have taken this bit of scripture and have used it as a way to formulaically pray to God. That's not his point. Notice what he says there in verse 9. He doesn't say, you always need to pray this. He says, pray then like this. This is an example to use. This is a model. This is a way of doing this. But you don't always have to say these specific words. But I want you to look at what the model is. In verse 9, what does a good prayer start with? A good prayer somehow starts with an acknowledgement of who God is, of praising Him. A good prayer starts with God. A good prayer does not start with me, right? In verse 10, a good prayer is focused on His desires and not just mine. A good prayer is asking that His domain, His name, His cause gets further distributed into the earth, into the hearts of mankind, spreading to more and more people. In verse 11, a good prayer asks God to provide the strength that our bodies and our minds need to go through whatever today holds. Because we don't know what is going to happen in an hour or two or three. Strength comes from God. And give us this day, our daily bread is a way of acknowledging, I need help for right now. Even though I might feel good, I need help right now for whatever today holds. In verse 12, a good prayer asks Him to give us what we most desperately need, which is Him to release us of our debts, with an eye on making sure that we are releasing the debts of people who have racked up debts against us. That's especially 14 and 15. He'll circle back to that because our forgiveness is conditional. If you want it from God, then you got to give it to the people. That's the way that that works. It doesn't work any other way, he says. And then verse 13, a good prayer asks God for His protection from the devil. Because that is an enemy that none of us are strong enough to fight by ourselves. No human has ever resisted all of the devil's temptations. And there have been billions and billions of us to come down the pike, and there are billions today. We all need help from our God. And so from start to finish, this model prayer is about pushing us toward dependence and away from independence and self-reliance. In other words, everything that America preaches. That's different from this prayer. I want you to notice 16 through 18, what he talks about with fasting. This is an interesting section to me. He says, what I want you to do when you fast is to make sure that you don't intentionally look like you just rolled out of bed and didn't do anything to your face or to your body in order to draw attention to yourself, to your spiritual focus that you're trying to do. Just look like a normal Joe. You'll practice some hygiene. Fasting was commanded under the law of Moses. But I think the interesting thing is, as far as I know, it was only commanded for one day of the year. And that was the very special Day of Atonement when the high priest would come into the most holy place, remember, and he would offer a sacrifice for his own sins, for the sins of the people. And on that day, you can read about this in Leviticus 16, Numbers 29, all of the people, not just the high priest, all of the people were supposed to afflict themselves. In other words, they're supposed to fast. What the Pharisees evidently did with that law is, and you can see this in Luke 18 in the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector praying in the temple, evidently the Pharisees were fasting twice a week and kind of looking at themselves as, well, I'm really great because I'm doing the law plus all these other great things. Under the new covenant of Jesus, though, fasting is not a requirement. But I think it's interesting that you do see Jesus just assuming that his people will be fasting. Did you notice the language of the text is not, you know, you could do this, whatever, but it's when you do it. It's the same kind of language as verse 2 and verse 5. It's when you pray, when you give, when you fast. And so, when you fast, however that looks like for you in your circumstances, make sure that you're not doing it to try to stand out from the crowd. Anoint your head. Wash your face. Brush your teeth. Take a shower. Look like a normal person. This is so applicable. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but if I'm being really honest with myself, there have been times where I've been tired from being in the trenches in a spiritual work, and I sort of intentionally, I mean, not all these things about not washing your face and so forth. Maybe some of these are not applicable. Maybe you just do that. But sometimes I've gone into assemblies of God's people, into places where others are around me, and I kind of intentionally looked a little droopy so that people will ask me about that, which is what the text is talking about. So that then I would have an opportunity to say, well, I mean, I've been doing this, and I've been doing that, and I've been doing that. And that's what he's addressing here. If people find out, that's fine, but do not try to attract attention by altering your mood, your face, the way that you appear. Don't be like a hypocrite. All right. This is the final slide. This is the summary wrap-up point, but I'm gonna be here for a little bit longer than I'm normally in conclusion, so hang tight for a second. I want us to think about this, what he's teaching here, about God's reward being better. I want you to think about human praise. Human praise is really, really limited. Let me illustrate that in a couple of different ways. So recently, I didn't watch the whole gold medal hockey game in the Olympics. I just saw the highlights. But like most of the rest of America, I was blown away by Connor Hallebuck. Like the guy's amazing. If I could talk to Connor Hallebuck and I had the opportunity to praise him for that game, I'm sure that he would appreciate it. I'm sure that he would say, well, you know, thank you for that. But that praise of him would be limited coming from me because that is the only game I've ever watched him in. I didn't even know who he was until that game. I had to Google, how do you pronounce his last name? Because I didn't know how to say it. I have not watched the hours and hours and hours and the games and the games and the games leading up to that gold medal game. I just saw a couple of highlights with the stick back here and the puck right there, and that was really cool. But my praise is really, really limited compared to the kind of player that he is. It would lack depth. Human praise is like that. It's limited because we only see small slivers of one another's lives. Even family members, even people that you really know well, we don't see everything. We're not around for every word, every deed. We can't see everything that is praiseworthy about someone else. We can't look into each other's hearts and see what's there at a glance like Jesus can. And also, human praise is really momentary. So right now, all across the nation, everybody knows Connor Hallibuck's name. He's getting a medal from the president. Like, he's got a gold medal now from Italy. He's really something, but it's momentary. Because I think other than hockey nerds, 30 years from now, nobody's going to be talking about him. Another example. I've heard many, many powerful presentations of the Bible in my short time span. And I've given many compliments to Bible teachers. But if you asked me to go back and list all the lessons that I thought were really good, and you asked me to describe their points, I would draw a lot of blanks. Because at the time, I thought, wow, that was really powerful. That really hit me. But now, 10, 15, 20 years later, I don't really remember what was being said. Praise is momentary. We long to be fully known and fully valued. But if we look to each other for that, it's not going to fill that void. We're going to be perpetually unsatisfied. But contrast that with God's praise. Contrast that with God's reward. It is not limited. Did you see three different times in the text? Three different times, what does Jesus say about God perceiving us? Your Father sees in secret. God sees all of the good that you do that other people see, but then he also sees the rest of what you do that nobody else is going to notice or see, perhaps ever. God hears every single word that you pray to him on behalf of other people that no other human is going to hear. He sees all of the blood and the sweat and the tears. They're all written down in his book. And that book is not on some dusty shelf in the corner of heaven where everybody forgets about it like the law in the days of Josiah. That book is front and center because it's got the record of his people in it. And that book's going to be open someday when all the books are opened. And your God will look at you and he will say, I saw every one of those things. I have saved you with the blood of my son. Well done, good and faithful servant. When he says that to you, it's not just going to mean something. It's going to mean everything. Because it is complete. He's got a full knowledge of you and what you have done. And it's going to be eternal. It's not going to be forgotten about because our God doesn't forget anyone. He's always going to delight in you, in his presence, eternally. Nothing about you is overlooked. That is a terrifying thought if you are a rebel against God, but that is just the most comforting thought in the world if you are a son or if you're a daughter, right? God's praise is complete and eternal. And so working for human praise is a paltry substitute for the eternal reward that God can provide. Now, in our time under the sun, before we reach this, is it a good thing to encourage each other with good words when we have opportunity to do that, when we do see something praiseworthy, should we be saying something? Yes, absolutely we should. We need to be Barnabases for each other because this life is difficult, and some encouraging words along the way are fuel in the tank, are they not? I was really touched whenever that was, that Ryan got up here on a Wednesday night and he said, you know, I've got a box. I think it was a box. A container that holds all of the different notes and the cards and the encouraging words that you guys have sent to him. He holds on to those. I'd smile when he said all those things because I happen to have a drawer in my office that I call the encouragement drawer, and it is only filled with notes and cards and words that Christians throughout the years that I've been doing this have written to me. Some of you have written some of those things to me. Thank you for those. I need to get better about writing cards to you, but I appreciate the encouragement you've given to me. And on the occasional day when I wonder why I ever decided to become a preacher, that drawer helps. Moments of human praise, when they come, are little gifts from God. But it comes when it comes. We dare not try to force those moments to happen, and we dare not hold on to those moments too tightly, lest we fall into the trap of what Jesus is talking about in verse 1. Beware, he says. Take care of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Our glory comes from God. So let's work for that. Appreciate your attention to his words today. If we can be of help to you this morning, we would love to know how we can do that. If you are convicted in your life that you're working for the wrong reward and you want to work for God's reward, he tells us in his word how to appreciate that, how to reach him. And we would love to be a small part of what that looks like for you. And so if we can help you this morning, however we can do that, let us know as we stand up and we sing the invitation song.